Second Court of Appeals this morning. I'm glad you were able to make it, and the weather was not bad. It was a little iffy yesterday, but we did it. We have one case on our 9 o'clock docket, and that's your case. I want to mention that we have a pending motion to dismiss, and we need to have that addressed first, because that affects our jurisdiction over this appeal. So if you'll keep that in mind when you argue, we'll appreciate it. And I'll ask Megan to call the case.
The court will now call Syntex Child Care versus Sheila Broderick Johnson et al. May it please the court, Mr. Wayne Hallisey to argue for appellant, and Mr. Jerry Poole and Mr. Randall Turner to argue for appellate.
Appellant's ready. May I approach, Your Honors?
Please.
May it please the court, Justice McCoy, Justice Gardner, Justice Walker. My name is Wade Hallisey, along with co-counsel Kevin Wentz. We represent the appellant in this case. Syntex Child Care, Inc., formerly known as MESA Services, Family Services, which I will refer to MESA throughout our arguments. Justices, first, with regard to this case, what we're really asking the court to do is to do what three panels of this court have previously done, and that is to extend the doctrine of official immunity to private parties who have entered into contracts with the government, whether a state or a political subdivision of the state. And in so doing, we are essentially asking this court to carry forward with that, with those same steps that this court has previously taken.
Well, that's a pretty broad statement. So you're telling me that Gifford Hill delivers dirt to TxDOT, Gifford Hill is immune from prosecution?
No, Your Honor.
Well, that's just what you said. Enters into contract with a governmental entity.
I think the distinction that would be made in the cases that this court has previously decided and the distinction that would be made in this case is that ordinarily that what we're frequently looking at is whether or not the party that has entered into the contract is performing a uniquely governmental function. Road work is not a uniquely governmental function.
Okay. Now we're narrowing down.
Correct. We're funneling it down. Okay. Yes.
Does it make a difference that the contractor performs services for the state entity, as opposed, like the example that he gave, as opposed to it acting as agent for?
Well, I think that, I mean, in this case, I mean, there's not going to be, we wouldn't be providing a service outside of the state itself. In other words, you know, we are dealing with, or MESA in particular, would have been caring for or placing foster children. There's no private means by which parties can come and take children out of someone's house and place them in another home. And so for that reason, that's what makes this different, essentially, that this is a uniquely governmental function in the other cases previously decided by the panels of this court. In the Guerrero versus Tarrant County Medical Examiner case, that was a situation in which it was, you know, there was a company that had contracted to secure human remains after fatalities that occurred or to investigate crime scenes. In the Knowles case, for instance, addressing, you know, the operation of an airport. So I think that what we're dealing with in this case is there's no other means, there's no private method by which someone can come and remove a child from a home. Therefore, that's what makes this situation different.
Does it matter that in none of those three cases the contract was the contract specifically had a provision, at least that appeared in the record, that said that they were an independent contractor?
I don't think that it does make a difference. I don't think that it is significant in that that the specific contract itself was laid out or not laid out. And I don't think that the idea of an agent and an independent contractor are mutually exclusive concepts either. I mean, I think that one can still be an independent contractor, but nonetheless be serving, you know, as the agent of the particular entity. So to answer the court's question, I don't think that necessarily that makes a distinction that was not specifically addressed in the other opinions that have previously issued out of this court. You're welcome.
So agency versus independent contractor makes no difference in your mind?
I don't think that it does. No. I don't think that the two are, again, I don't think that you have to have one without the other. That's it. I don't think that you have to have one without the other. The idea that that an independent contractor, if an independent contractor is unable to somehow secure official immunity by virtue of this agency relationship, I think that the problem that the court would run into is then that if it's going to come down to a right of control, in other words, the governmental entity every time is going to have the right to control what occurs, then I don't think that official immunity could ever be extended to any private party. Because the second step in the test is the idea that it's a discretionary function, okay, that the contractor or that the actor, is involved in some process that involves deliberation, that involves decision, that involves judgment. And if the government retains control over every one of those things, then I think that every decision by definition would be a ministerial function, therefore meaning that official immunity would never exist outside the context of a true, pure government actor, only to a state agency, only to a state actor. And we know that not only decisions from this court, but from San Antonio, from Texarkana, we have seen that this doctrine has been extended to others in the performance of those duties.
Okay, even if the doctrine has been extended to others, how do you get an interlocutory appeal? How come this just isn't developed at trial, and then if there's an incorrect application of official immunity, then it's raised on appeal after trial?
I think the problem with that, Justice Walker, is that then what it really is that it's an illusory, for lack of a better term, it's an illusory defense, because the defense only applies if the trial court agrees with you in the lower court. The idea behind immunity.
That's not true. What I'm saying is that you can present evidence of your categorization that you've just argued to the court. That would be evidence presented at trial, and then after trial, you could appeal that determination, which is what the law was for 51014, pulled this particular defense into the interlocutory appealable statute.
But then we've lost the very right that it is to be conferred by the idea of immunity. That is that you shouldn't have to go through all the steps of a trial, that you shouldn't have to take every one of those, that if immunity exists, then you should be able to assert that so as to avoid all of the incidents necessary with the trial, the expenses, the time, everything that's involved with it.
Well, is this a fact-driven determination? Hence, isn't this a jury question? It's a fact-driven determination, and I think, to use your phrase, if whoever this is standing in the shoes of or acting as the governmental agent, well, that's fact-driven, isn't it?
No, courts routinely make the determination about immunity on summary judgment. I mean, that's frequently done. So
this is different. We're not talking about, there's no fact question that TxDOT is an arm of the state. There is a question as to whether or not you're actually standing in the shoes of TxDOT, or here, a different entity.
I think that we've addressed that in terms of it in coming. I don't know that it is a fact question. I mean, I think the court can make that determination as to who we are or what it is that we are doing. I mean, we are performing that governmental function. That is, we're performing the same function that TDFPS performs. And so I don't know that it would be a fact question. I think that it's something that a court can determine as a matter of law as to whether it applies to us. And for that reason, I think that's why the same rule that would apply to a TxDOT, to a TDFPS, would in the same way apply to Mesa Family Services.
Okay, I understand your position.
Okay. On the summary judgment record that currently appears before the court, backing up just a second, in support of our motion for summary judgment, we put in, I think, voluminous evidence as to addressing the three essential steps of the official immunity defense. The idea that we had, that we were acting within the scope of our authority, that we were performing discretionary functions, and that we carried out those steps in good faith. More importantly, there is no summary judgment evidence to the contrary in this case. We've come forward, first off, with regard to the authority. I think it's quite obvious by virtue of the contract that we had, that it was part of our, within our authority to verify the Warner home, that was in our authority to run background checks on the Warners, that was in our authority to supervise the home, train the Warners, monitor the home. And I think we've set forth all that summary judgment evidence, which not only establishes, number one, that we were acting within the scope of our authority, but number two, that we were performing discretionary functions. As I noted earlier, with regard to any type of a decision that is going to involve judgment, discretion, or deliberation, these are the very things that we were doing. We were making decisions about who goes into a home and who stays in a home. So from that standpoint, I think that we clearly meet the discretionary function part of the test. The next part of the test comes in is, did we act in good faith? I think the best evidence that we have comes from the state itself. When the state issued its letter finding, coming back to Mesa, essentially stating, we made a determination that the foster father who was in the home was responsible for the death of Sierra Odom, and that the agency found no deficiencies that could be assigned as to Mesa. When we look at good faith and whether our actions were objectively reasonable in light of the facts, I think that evidence coming from the state sort of goes beyond what you'd ordinarily see. This is the very agency that is charged with monitoring us. This is the very agency that issues a license to us. This is the very agency that comes in and investigates afterward. This agency, having reviewed this entire incident, returned to us and stated, there are no deficiencies attributable to you. As such, I think the Mesa has very clearly met the three elements that we would need to meet to establish our entitlement to official immunity, which in turn puts the burden back on to the appellees in this case. And again, if we go back to the summary judgment record that is before the court, there is no evidence that has come forward that would be sufficient to overcome the burden that now shifts back to them. There's a copy of a contract and a copy of a letter that has been submitted by the Johnson Odom appellees. As far as Ms. Jameson goes, there is no summary judgment evidence in the record as to her, because they have failed to come forward with sufficient summary judgment evidence to overcome that burden coming backward. The trial court erred. The trial court should have granted summary judgment, and that is what we're asking this court to do, is to reverse, obviously, and to render judgment in our favor on that defense. With respect to some of the arguments that have been put forward as to the, as to whether or not, first off, summary judgment can go to Mesa as a company, I think that we have established in our briefing for the court, one need not be a natural person in order to be entitled to official immunity. We have seen official immunity found in cases of limited partnerships, general partnerships. So clearly, the type of entity, the type of person, the type of private party who is asserting or claiming the entitlement to the immunity defense.
You might not have to be a person to claim official immunity, but don't you have to be an officer or employee of the state or a political subdivision of the state to claim the right to an interlocutory appeal?
Well, I guess my initial response to that would be that I know that the same statute was in place at the time that the put-off case was decided. And Dr. Pirwani's professional association was before the court at that time. And this court found that Dr. Pirwani's professional association had properly perfected the appeal. As we had noted in our response to the motion to dismiss, it's an employee or an officer. And officers are those who carry out sovereign functions of the state. And it's our position that essentially we are carrying out a sovereign function of the state to the extent that we are carrying out the same duties that the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services would be required to carry out with respect to the placement, the monitoring, and the supervision of foster children placed into homes verified through the Child Placement Agency.
And that very well may be for purposes of official immunity, but my question is, wouldn't it be reasonable to assume that the legislature decided to include this particular provision for an interlocutory appeal to keep expenses of the state down and to keep appellate expenses from the state coffers down. And since you are a private for-profit corporation, that particular interlocutory appeal section doesn't apply to you.
Again, I certainly concede that that argument could be made, but I think that the same justifications, the same policy considerations that would go into who would be entitled to take that appeal nonetheless apply. I mean, if the court is going to grant the motion to dismiss, then what we may very well wind up finding ourselves in a position is then perhaps seeking mandamus relief, which I know the courts of appeals are not fans of, but to the extent that we are not able to claim a defense to which we would be otherwise entitled.
You can claim the defense, and you can raise the defense at trial. You just can't appeal from the trial court's denial of your motion for summary judgment.
True. But, and again, if we are acting, our position would be that if we are acting as the state, then we should be very well entitled to the same protections as the state. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Jerry Coyle here for the Johnson plaintiffs. Your honors, what this boils down to is that Mesa is an independent contractor and has been from the get-go. Mesa is asking this court to ignore the plain language of the contract that Mesa signed. First paragraph of the contract, Mesa Family Services, an independent contractor. Every case that has addressed the question of official immunity has done so on the basis that the person getting official immunity is a public official, meaning an employee or agent of the state. Mesa is putting a great deal of stock in the...
Are you taking the position that an independent contractor can't be an agent?
By definition, Your Honor, an independent contractor is not an agent. That's settled law in... settled agency law that an independent contractor is not an agent. If the principal has the right to control the details of the actions of the contractor, then the contractor is not independent but is an agent of the principal. Or if there is a contractual arrangement by which the agent stands in the shoes of the principal, like a law firm, then an agency relationship is established. The converse of that is an independent contractor status. There must be 1,000 cases on the books addressing the question whether an employee or a sub-entity, is an agent or an independent contractor. It is always a factual question. The courts look to the contractual documents, which we have in this case. The contractual documents either define the agent's status as independent contractor or agent, or they look at the relationship between the parties, and if the principal has the right to control the details of the actions of the agent, then an agency relationship is established, and that person is no longer an independent contractor. And that's what's at stake here. That very well may be true, but I think he's wrong in his claim that the nature of the entity does not make a difference. Now, one can be a separate entity. I'm not going to take the position that a separate entity, for example, a law firm, or in the case of the medical examiner, his professional association, those legal entities can nonetheless be agents of the state, and a law firm is the best example I can think of an agent that is an agent by contract. A law firm literally stands in the shoes of the client, and not just the individual lawyer, but the entire firm has an attorney-client relationship with the client, which is that it applies to all of the cases involving the law firm hired to collect delinquent taxes, which is most of the law in this area has revolved around a law firm that is hired to collect delinquent taxes, and there's some sort of a dispute and a claim against the law firm. Those are classic agency cases by definition. There is no case, including the Knowles case upon which they rely, in which the court has found that an agent or that a party that is not an agent is entitled to official immunity. I think what happened in the Knowles case, which is, as I read their brief, is the chief argument upon which they base their brief, I think what happened in the Knowles case is the court used some inapt language. And they said in the Knowles case, whether one is an independent contractor or agent has no legal significance. But then they went on to analyze the case, and their analysis, in fact, found that the airport manager was an agent of the state. They decided that he was a public official, that he was performing a state function. And then they took the analysis one step further in the Knowles case, by the way. Then they looked at the classic analysis for an independent contractor and asked whether, if one is an agent of the state, were their actions within the course and scope of their employment or agency? And in the Knowles case, the court in fact found that the airport manager's actions were not within the course and scope, and therefore he lost his official immunity. Your Honors, that is standard independent contractor agency law, and that's where we are.
All right, so still the difference down between you and his position is, it doesn't matter if you're an independent contractor agent, if you're standing in the shoes of the state performing a government function, your position is you can't do that unless you're an agent. You can't do that as an independent contractor.
My position, Your Honor, is you cannot stand in the shoes,
right,
to use his language. In fact, standing in the shoes is the euphemism for agency that's been used for as long as I've been practicing law. And in this case, not only do we have a contractor in which the state specifically contracted with Mesa and defined Mesa as an independent contractor, we have settled law out of the Houston Court of Appeals, the Schutz case, 101 Southwest 3rd 512, which held that the department is not a child placing agency. What the Schutz case means in the context of our case today is that the department contracted with an independent contractor to do something that the department did not do. The department, according to the Schutz case, is not a child placing agency. By contract and by license, Mesa was. This is not a governmental function. This is a case in which the government has contracted with an outside entity to do something that the state was not doing, and in which the state specifically defined this outside entity as an independent contractor. The jurisdictional question and this question run together. They are essentially the same question. Our contention is that Mesa is not entitled to this appeal because they are not a public official or employee. And when we get down to the question of Mesa's potential liability, which of course is a fact question and that's not before the court, but that question is also a question that should not be addressed by this court, because Mesa has the burden of proving, actually we have the burden of proving that Mesa is in fact an independent contractor. But Mesa has submitted nothing except, I think, smoke and mirrors, and asking this court to ignore the plain language of the contract. They've submitted nothing that suggests that Mesa has any different status. What I hear them doing is playing with words. They say Mesa stands in the shoes of the state, but at the same time, that Mesa is an independent contractor who somehow stands in the shoes of the state. The argument they're making, Your Honors, makes no sense. This case comes down to whether Mesa is a public official. And an independent contractor, by definition, is not a public official or employee. And that's where our case is. This case, in my judgment, analyzes very much like the Atwood case.
Wait, but he's an agent.
I beg your pardon?
You just said that, by definition, a public official is not an independent contractor. By definition,
An agent under the answer to that question, I think, is yes. And it's in the Civil Practices and Remedies Code, which defines, what I'm referring to, Your Honor, is the Texas Tort Claims Act, and when it's defining who is entitled to claim sovereign immunity, and it defines an employee under the Act. An employee means a person, including an officer or agent, who is in the paid service of a governmental unit by competent authority, but does not include an independent contractor, an agent or employee of an independent contractor, or a person who performs tasks the details of which the governmental unit does not have the legal right to control. Civil Practices and Remedies Code, Section 101.001. The legislature has defined the status of the parties in this case. They've done so in the context of sovereign immunity. My contention is that official immunity is a species of the general doctrine of sovereign immunity, and that this definition in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, in the Tort Claims Act, is dispositive. It defines the status of the parties. Mesa is an independent contractor. By definition, they are not an employee or agent. If they were an agent, the Tort Claims Act defines them as an employee, and therefore, arguably, assuming that all the other factors are in play, arguably entitled to official immunity. But that's not what we have. What we have is a contract that defines Mesa's status. And Mesa, at all points, is an independent contractor doing something that the Schutz case says that the department does not do, that is, function as a child placing agency. The case that I think is most like the case we have is the Atwood case out of Houston from some years ago, I think 2001. It was a wrongful death case. It involved a child who drowned in a swimming pool, and suit was brought against the department claiming that the foster parents who held the license in that case were agents of the state, and therefore they were making a respondeat superior argument trying to hold the state liable by the actions of the licensee. The Houston court said that the licensee was not the agent of the state. The doctrine of respondeat superior did not apply, and they dismissed the case. What we have is the reverse of that. We have an argument, we have a case here in which we are arguing that Mesa is not the agent of the state. We have a case in which Mesa is not the agent of the state, and this appeal should be dismissed. And I'm going to yield to my co-counsel, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court. Your Honors, this court does not have jurisdiction to hear this case. 51.014 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code allows an interlocutory appeal of the denial of a motion for summary judgment. only a person can do this based on an assertion of immunity by an individual who is an officer or an employee. Now, the Texas Supreme Court has said that this provision of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code must be strictly construed. There's no other way to read it. This court just does not have jurisdiction. The Houston Court of Appeals has said that, quote, there's no other way to read section 51.014A5 than to conclude that only an individual who is an officer or employee of the state or a political subdivision of the state may appeal an interlocutory order denying a motion for summary judgment. So this court simply does not have appeal. I quickly want to address, I want to point out to the court on the issue of can this corporation assert official immunity. No court in Texas has addressed the issue of whether or not a corporation may assert official immunity. It has not been discussed by any court. There are courts where non-human beings have been granted official immunity, but that was never discussed. For example, in Puthoff, the issue was whether a medical examiner could assert official immunity. There was no discussion about the fact that he was a PA. That was never brought up, never discussed. The court said, we hold Dr. Pirwani, PA, and Dr. Putoff as medical examiners, enjoy the same official immunity as other public officials. The Guajardo case out of the 14th Court. The issue in that case was whether attorneys representing the government could assert official immunity, even though they're not government employees. The court said yes. If you look at all these cases, City of Houston, the Guerrero case, none of these cases ever discussed can a corporation assert official immunity. And I'm here to say that to allow a corporation to assert official immunity totally defeats the purpose of official immunity and the public policy behind it. The policy is to give people the give them the freedom to perform their jobs without fear of a personal lawsuit. Corporations don't make decisions. They don't make discretionary decisions. Their officers, employees, agents, and board members do, but corporations do not. So I'm saying that the public policy and behind official immunity can't apply to corporations. I'll see. Does anybody have any questions? Do any of your honors have any questions?
So that would be the basis for distinguishing our previous cases where we held that those organizations, such as law firms,
yes, ma'am,
and PAs are subject to immunity.
Yes, if you read those, the Fort Worth cases, there was no discussion of, well, should a PA be given official immunity? It was all about, can a medical examiner have official immunity? And then your court looked at other courts where medical examiners have been given official immunity. But if you read the cases, there's not a single case where a court of appeals has ever said, you know, a corporation can be entitled to official immunity. It was never discussed, never addressed. It was never an issue. This will open up a huge can of worms if we hold that any corporation that enters into a contract with the state of Texas is going to be entitled to official immunity. I mean, that's going to be a pretty profound change in the law. Thank you, Your Honors.
We are not positing that every corporation that ever enters into any contract with the state or with one of its political subdivisions automatically claims immunity. As I said in first addressing the court, this is about a contractor that is performing a uniquely governmental function.
Well, apparently that's an issue. There's a dispute about that. Sounds like a fact question to me, but
well, it's certainly not our. It certainly is our position that it would be limited in that way, Justice McCoy.
Tell us again about you're an officer.
I'm sorry.
You're going to tell us again about why you're an officer allowed to bring an interlocutory
appeal. If
or some other phrase that's in there. All I heard you might stretch to was officer.
Well, I mean, I think that we would fall under. I think we would fall under that officer distinction. I mean, if. First, the idea that entities have not, I mean, we've had limited partnerships that have been able to assert immunity. Absolutely. We have, we've had general partnerships that have been able to assert immunity. And so with all of these, again, I don't think that the type of entity it is important. As I think that I had discussed in our briefing of the court, yes, then I think we would probably, if we're choosing between employee and officer, yes, and I think we'd be close to an officer or an official, okay, because we'd be carrying out, a sovereign function of the state. Again, this is what the court essentially did with Dr. Pirwani's professional association. I mean, this court said, Dr. Pirwani, PA, Dr. Pirwani, PA, and Dr. Pirwani's. I agree, but I also appreciate that there's a difference between a professional association and the doctor who comprises the professional association.
It was not discussed in the case.
It was not discussed in the case, and I grant the point. It was not discussed, or maybe that it was seen and acknowledged, and the decision was made that we don't need to address that. With regard to Mr. Coyle has referenced the Schutz case, and the Schutz case says that the state is not a child placement agency. Someone had better tell the Department of Family and Protective Services, because in its own handbooks, the Department of Family and Protective Services defines itself as a child placement agency. And so the state is, you know, the state indeed is characterizing itself.
If they're a child placement agency, why hire you?
Because they need, because there are more kids than the state can than the state can keep up with.
So basically you're telling us that they're out doing this very same job that you were doing, and in addition they hired you to do it.
Yes. That's absolutely what
it's easy to prove as a fact
question. I mean, that is absolutely what they are doing. I mean, the reason that we are that the state contracts with other agencies to carry out its jobs is because the state can't keep up, and the state can't do it.
Are there provisions in the Human Resources Code that cover the appointment or employment of child placement, private child placement agencies?
There are.
By the department? And
There are provisions that address the regulation of child placement agencies, yes. And there are, you know, there are also provisions, I think, as we've cited to in our brief, that note that, you know, the department has the authority to go out and enter into contracts with various entities to carry out any of its functions. Our argument being, if TDFPS is going to go and give its employees codified official immunity, which is what the state has done at Section 40.061 of the Texas Human Resources Code, it has codified official immunity for those who are in the employee and carrying out the duties of the department. The department, which defines itself in its own printed materials as a child placement agency, and if those employees are entitled to those protections, then we are entitled to that same immunity that the Department of Family and Protective Services has given itself. I'll cede the remainder of my time.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you for your arguments. Thank you for your good briefs. Your case is submitted. The motion to dismiss is submitted. We've been carrying it up to this time. And you will be hearing from us shortly. And you're excused. Thank you very much for making
it. Thank you, Your Honor.
All rise.
Yes.
The Office Court of Appeals for the Second.